Sarah Carter Show. I am coming to you from my home studio, still in semi-lockdown here in Virginia, but I'm making my way out. We're slowly and surely making our way out. I'm still going to the grocery store. We're all wearing masks, right? We're all trying to figure this out ourselves. And that's why today I have a lot of special guests. I've got two very special guests, actually. Kimberly Guilfoy is on with me today. She's going to be talking about all the great things the Trump campaign is doing remotely and how they're managing to handle this, you know, long distance. And she's going to talk about Latino voters, something that former Vice President Joe Biden apparently does not think he needs. He does not think he needs any Latino voters. And we're going to explain why that is not the path to victory. You got to be inclusive of everyone. And the Latino community in the United States is one of the fastest growing communities and actually a very conservative one. And that's why I'm really grateful to be having Kimberly on the show to talk about that. I also have Jenna Ellis. She is the senior legal advisor to the Trump reelection campaign. And I'm going to have her talking a little bit about coronavirus vaccines. What does that mean? Will we be forced? Alan Dershowitz talked about that on Tucker Carlson's show. Jenna Ellis has a different opinion on that. She said we cannot be forced to be vaccinated, although there are, you know, and she talks about the legal aspects of that, not whether or not that is right or wrong. It's just about the legal aspects. What does it mean when there is a vaccine developed? How are we going to handle that as a society and what we are going to do? Also, anytime you guys want to read the latest stories, you go to sarahacarter.com. That's sarahacarter.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at sarahcarterdc and on Instagram. On Instagram, I am scarterdc, not the full name, scarterdc on Instagram. I like to post there often just things that have nothing to do with any of the stories I've been working on. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I post clips from this show there. But a lot of times I just post things that I think are interesting and want to share them with you, which is usually me trying to be a mom here at home, balancing out all of those duties of homeschooling and being there for my family first, as well as my job, you know, and I know all of you are going through those same issues. I was talking to Jenny Terry, you know, she works for me. And whenever you're on sarahcarter.com, you'll see her great stories there. She's been wonderful at keeping up all of those stories on our website, especially during this lockdown. But one of the things that I think has been so extraordinary is learning how to really be there for my family and also trying to balance out the job. And I talk to parents all the time about this, friends of mine who are saying, wow, you know, I learned so much about what my child's learning at school. I realize how much I appreciate their teachers. And I appreciate, you know, the people that are there for my children when I have to go to work every day, you know. And I think it's hard. It's really tough. I think this COVID-19 coronavirus, Wuhan virus lockdown, and this is just getting personal here, you know, has been tough on families. We're trying to find that balance between our lives, you know, our personal lives and our professional lives. But we've also, I think, have been blessed in a way, I know I have, to really be with the family and to really understand that your families do come first and that your country comes first. And that we together are trying to figure this out. And what a remarkable nation we are, because we've been through so much in the last few months. But overall, no matter how divisive we are politically, we really have stuck together as a community and as a nation. And I can see that we're coming through this. We're getting out of this, right? There is light at the end of the tunnel. We have our elections in November. There's a lot of stories around that, whether or not we're doing in mail, how you guys feel about mail-in voting, how you feel about going to the polls. What does this mean? It's a historic election. I feel like everything that's happened in President Trump's administration has been historic. It's been incredible, you know, from everything he's done foreign policy-wise, even moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and recognizing that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, from that historic moment to everything that happens to us nationally here on a national level. You know, it's been historic. And as Americans, each of us, each individual is living in this really remarkable time in history. And we're at a precipice in a way of protecting our civil liberties, protecting our rights as individuals, and how important that is, and protecting the foundation of our nation, right? So we've had this brutal lesson in what can happen. We're a global world, we're a small world. You know, this virus came from China, came across the globe, has affected our European partners, our Central America. There isn't a place on earth that this virus has not affected in one way or another. And one of the things that I think became so prominent for me and thinking about this is like how important our civil liberties are, how important that is to defend. And it wasn't the first time. And the reason why I say, you know, for me, this presidency, the Trump administration, President Trump is so historical is because so much has happened. I mean, 3.5 years ago, I want to play a clip for you and then I'll explain it to you. Adam, can we play the clip from 2017? This is me on my great friend Sean Hannity's show in May 2017.
If it's political surveillance on opponents, what would that mean in terms of scandal to this country?
It would be one of the biggest scandals this country has ever seen, if that's proven. And all you have to do is go back to 2011 when they loosened up these rules. John and I reported on this. And then we see an increase of this. We see slowly but surely increase of unmasking Americans and leaking of information. But what we don't know, Sean, yet is why. And that's why this investigation needs to continue, both for John and I, as well as for the Senate, and as well as for Congress, to continue to ask these questions. Susan Rice needs to answer these questions. Director Clapper, former Director Clapper, needs to answer these questions, as well as Director Brennan. We need to know what they were looking at and why. And if they were compiling dossiers on political opponents, that needs to be disclosed. That cannot be held under the shield of classified information.
Right. So that was in 2017, folks. That was May 2017. May 2017.
Nailed it.
I started to see information. I had sources. You're right, Adam. And it shocked me. I was stunned at how far, you know, senior level officials in the United States government under the Obama administration had gone. And I was at the tip of the iceberg, really. Really there at the very beginning of seeing possibly what was happening here, that there were unmaskings for political purposes, that people were being spied on by what? By a political opponent, not by the Russians, not by the Chinese, not by the Pakistanis, but by government officials from an opposing party that wanted to keep basically those policies intact and in place, even if the American people, which they did, voted for President Trump and no longer wanted those policies, some of those policies in place, voted for a new president, for a new administration, were seeking a new direction, that there were people within the administration, Obama administration, that were willing to step all over the foundation of this government, of our Constitution, of our Fourth Amendment rights, in order to ensure that their policies would move forward. I want you to think about this, because this is what it was all about. Those folks, John Brennan, the former CIA director, James Clapper, the former head director of national intelligence, James Comey, former FBI director who was fired by President Trump, Andy McCabe, his deputy director. I could go on and on and on. All of these people played a crucial role in doing something that has never happened before in the history of this country. They basically weaponized all of the systems that we trust in order, what I believe, and I will say it again, I said it in 2017, to build dossiers basically on political opponents. We now know for a fact that they did this to Michael Flynn. We saw the documents. the acting director of national intelligence. Well, now, I mean, it's John Ratcliffe. That was the big news today. He is now going to take the place of where Rick Grenell was. But I got to tell you, there is nobody that has done the most remarkable job, the most remarkable job that anyone could have done in the intelligence community like Rick Grenell has done. He is phenomenal. He was able to declassify documents that nobody in the government, especially all these, I call them deep state embedders, these bureaucrats that really do not care. They don't want you to know the truth. They don't want you to know how they've been running the government. They want you to continue to use your taxpayer dollars to pay them so that they can work against you. Okay? Because this wasn't just about President Trump and the Trump administration. This was about a duly elected president. And how do you get the duly elected president? Well, the American people vote for him. So everything that happened was against you, the American people. And you have acting director of national intelligence, Rick Grenell, who went in there and said, no, this is not going to happen anymore. I'm not going to allow this to happen. And boy, did he get pushback. Did he get pushback in the intelligence community? And he declassified documents that we have been waiting for years. And one of them was the unmasking documents, which exposed that Michael Flynn, basically people in the Obama administration, 16 senior officials, that included Brennan, it included others, Samantha Power, former United Nations ambassador, Susan Rice, national security advisor, others, had all, James Clapper, had been unmasking Michael Flynn. So we got 16 senior Obama officials unmasking, making requests to unmask Michael Flynn. Samantha Power did it 7 times. It was 48 times altogether. But those are only what we know. And remember what I said in the clip just moments ago with Sean Hannity, right? This wasn't just Michael Flynn. This isn't about just Michael Flynn. They had expanded the unmasking procedures like had never been done before in any administration. Under Obama, he did this. Not only did he allow more people to unmask within the government, within the intelligence agencies, right, and law enforcement agencies, he also expanded who you could spy on. I want you to think about this. Obama expanded it to the point where journalists, members of the clergy, journalists, lawyers, doctors could be spied on by the U.S. government. Think about how dangerous that is. So now that we know Michael Flynn, there were, 48 requests to unmask his name. Now Senator Lindsey Graham is saying, whoa, wait a minute. But there were a lot more unmaskings than Michael Flynn. It wasn't just about Michael Flynn. Just like I said in May 2017, a lot more than Michael Flynn. Now Lindsey Graham is saying, I want to know who else in the Trump administration was unmasked. And I want you to think about this, folks. It's far beyond even the Trump administration. Mark my words. Mark my words. This went far beyond the Trump administration. I bet you people in the Obama administration abused this power to spy on people that were maybe opposed to the Iran deal, opposed to policies within Barack Obama's government, that they abused this system over and over again. And what about this? What about just spying on, judges or people that were of interest to them? Because abuse of power goes quite far, especially when the person that's doing the abusing thinks they can get away with it. And why did they think they could get away with it? You know why they thought that? Because it's classified, because it's considered top secret. They never suspected. First of all, they never suspected, and we've said this over and over again, that Trump was going to win this election. They believed wholeheartedly up until that last day, even when the New York Times had Hillary on November 9th, actually had Hillary winning by 95%, right? Remember that? On the day of the election in 2016, they all thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. That's why they were all at the Javits Center. They were at her private party near the Javits Center. They, everyone. everyone, even people from Robert Mueller's special counsel, like Andrew Weissman. I'm going to be talking about him a little bit too. By the way, Andrew Weissman's going to have a, you know, a fireside chat to raise money for Joe Biden. Isn't that sweet? Here's the guy that was part of the special counsel throwing a fundraiser for Vice President Joe Biden. Go figure. It was always like this. These people were always against President Trump and against you, the American people. But what they thought was, okay, classified, right? So all of this information is classified. Nobody's ever going to see the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act application on Carter Page. Wrong. We saw it. We saw it. It was filled with lies and omissions. But they never thought that would come out. Why? Because this is the most highly classified information that they could have on a U.S. citizen. But once we started peeling back the layer of that onion and or unraveling the threads, those threads just started to unravel. And I know Sean Hannity brought up on Monday's show, I was on a show with him Monday, and he said, you know, I know Sarah will remember this, but we were told that we were also, you know, unmasked or spied on. We were. I mean, there were numerous warnings early on, especially early on in my investigation into what was happening, when I felt like I was on an island floating by myself. And there were people out there saying, you know what, Sarah, if you're not right about this, your career's over. You're done. And I said, you know what? I don't care. My only job is to get the truth out to the American people. That's all that's important here. And they were right. I mean, if for some reason our government officials decided not to declassify these documents, didn't tell you the truth, then I think I would have felt, and John Solomon and others who have written on this, Chuck Ross, Molly Hemingway, Byron York, who's done some really great, Lee Smith. But we would have been out there just, you know, on our own, trying to tell the story from sources. But those actual documents are facts. They're facts. But those same documents were the documents that the Obama officials never thought would be public. So we can't stop here. We have to ensure that all of our agencies, folks, the FBI, by the way, Christopher Wray, FBI director, he needs to go. He needs to go. That man is an impediment because all he is doing is protecting the bureaucracy. He is not there to protect the American people. He's there to protect the bureaucracy. That's why he doesn't want people to talk to Congress. He doesn't want to, you know, abide by subpoenas that, you know, the Senate or Congress wants with some of the folks inside the FBI. We need the truth. We need to disinfect. We need to clean out these agencies. We need to give these agencies back to the American people. Because why? Because we pay their salaries, folks. We pay their salaries. They work for us. They are not over us. Remember, we're in charge here. This is the United States of America. Once we give this up, you want to hand this over, we're no better than China. What those folks did, it wasn't even just Banana Republic. It's like they just decided that they were going to abuse power. They think they're better than you. They think they're smarter than you. They think they're more important than you. And right now, I want to thank, you know, Sean Hannity, actually, number one, for allowing me to actually tell the story for the last 3 years, being the one person that actually believed that what we were telling was the truth, giving us a platform so that we could get the stories out there, so that Congress could investigate, so that the Senate could investigate. You know, there's only so much that a journalist can do. There's only so far that we can go because, you know, I can't take classified documents. Those have to be declassified. That is illegal. So if somebody would have leaked me some of those classified documents, I may not go to jail, but they would. And I wouldn't want that to happen to good people. And I'm grateful that it happened the right way. But I do. I want to thank Fox and Sean Hannity and you know, John and everybody who we worked together to expose the truth. But we still haven't received all the truth yet. And now we're dealing with coronavirus, and now we're dealing with the new election come November. And there's all kinds of issues that we're dealing with as Americans. And we have common sense, and we're a beautiful, smart, strong nation. And we should not give that up. We should not forget who we are. And we should not forget that we should never become complacent. We should not forget about the people that have fought for this country, that have done everything they can to protect this nation, even give their lives for this country. They did this for us. So we can't become complacent. We can't become lazy. We have to look forward. We have to realize that this November election is going to be the most crucial. I mean, I thought November 2016, I thought that was it. I thought that was the most crucial. No, it's this election coming up, November 2020. We have to protect our country, our civil liberties, and our nation from what we know can happen and what we know did happen under the previous administration. And that's why I have Kimberly Guilfoy on. I'm so excited because she is going to go into detail, folks. She is going to go into detail about what we need to do as a country, you know, in order to keep involved in our political process and why the Latino vote, you out there, in, like me, I'm Cuban. My mom's side, I'm Cuban on my mom's side. I spent, you know, I grew up in California with my mom's family after my father died. And, you know, my life was in a Latino community. I know this community well. I spend a lot of time covering Central America and the U.S.-Mexico border and immigration and all kinds of issues, because this is where I grew up. These were my people. And I understand this conservative, beautifully strong community that is a part of our nation, that wants to be a part of our nation, and what Donald Trump is doing to reach out to the Latino community in the United States and really, really bring them into the fold. Say, hey, we want to hear your voice. We want you to be a part of this. Kimberly Guilfoy is a senior advisor to the Donald J. Trump campaign 2020, and she's here with us now. Hi, Kimberly. I'm so happy to have you here at the Sarah Carter Show. Thank you so much for taking your time to be here. I know how busy you must be, but I want to start out first really quick. How has it been for you in lockdown, still running the campaign?
Yeah, it's been pretty incredible because we were able to take our complete campaign operation virtual in less than 24 hours. And I think it's also a testament to the people that we have on board that are working for the president's reelection, how creative they are. They are entrepreneurs. They think outside the box. And we have not literally taken the foot off the gas. And we are doing 2 to 3 virtual fundraisers a week. We've appointed 50 state captains running throughout the country, bundling, raising money for the president. So it's been fantastic. And the president's very pleased with it because it really just goes to show the robust support for the president during this difficult time for the country. And while he's busy trying to fight to save the country and reopen America and get that American economy, that engine started back up again, we have his back. We're giving him fuel in the tank. So he has the ability and the means to be able to take it across the finish line on November 3rd. And meanwhile, Sleepy Joe is taking cat naps in his basement and has no clue if he's running for president or senator. So good luck to them.
Well, that's a really good point, because right now, I mean, this is historic. We've never seen this happen before in an election cycle, right? In a campaign where you're doing everything virtually. Pretty much what President Trump is the best at is, I mean, his rallies. He's amazing. Yeah. Just talking directly to the American people. He does the same even when he's on television, but everybody loves to go to President Trump's rallies. And one 100%. Of the biggest growing groups is the Hispanic groups, Latinos yes. in yes. America. And it's interesting. I got a story right in front of me. Biden campaign doesn't consider Latinos part of their path to victory. That's incredible when it's one of the fastest growing groups. You speak Spanish. Your mother was Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. Your father was Irish. We just talked about that. But you really go out and you speak directly to the Latino Absolutely. Americans. Tell us why that's so important right now and why President Trump is so focused.
Can you even imagine? I mean, Joe Biden. So that's his campaign. So what is his slogan there? Leave all Latinos behind? Because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like he's writing off some of the best, the brightest people who have come in here that are part of the American economy have done better than ever under President Trump. President Trump won on the whole motto of, you know, leaving no American behind, remembering the forgotten man and woman. And now it just seems that, you know, Joe Biden considers that Latinos are dispensable, that he's not going to focus on them in his campaign. Well, guess what? If that isn't a wake-up call, what is? It's because his poll numbers are abysmal. They're bottomed out as it relates to the Latinos, and more Latinos are embracing the Republican Party and the GOP under President Trump more than ever before, because Latinos are doing better under President Trump. They are re-entering the workforce. They are entrepreneurs, opening small businesses. It was a record low unemployment for Latinos, men and women, under President Trump. We're going to get that back going again. And they also share the values that the president has espoused in terms of his policies. He's been incredible in terms of his picks for all the judges and justices, two incredible conservative Supreme Court justices. Latinos, we focus on those family values, traditional values. We believe in faith. We believe in God and spirituality. And we believe in equality of opportunity, but not necessarily a result. We don't want a handout. We come to this country to be able to fight to get the American dream, and we embrace the president's America First policies, which we've seen the thread here in terms of the president talking about this American jobs, American manufacturing, American infrastructure. Under President Trump, the American dream lives here. We are no longer exporting the American dream to countries that hate us and that we'll see, you know, our ill will is what they focus on. And we've seen this with China. We've seen this with the coronavirus epidemic. And so who do you want? President Trump with American First policies, or Joe Biden and his crew, the first family of China? That's nowhere for this country. Yeah, that's canceled.
Oh, no, it's very good that you brought this up. You know, the first family of China, because we're seeing so much information, so much evidence come out now more than ever on Joe Biden's connections with China, particularly when he was a vice president under Barack Obama. But I want to go back to the Latino issue, because I think this is so important. I mean, you brought up a really good point. Latinos have a very conservative base. Yeah. And the only time I ever see the Democrats reach out to the Latino community, and I saw this even in my own community in Los Angeles, right, is when they feel like they can get something from them, right?
Right.
When there's, and then they deliver these promises that they never fulfill. They never fulfill for the Latino community. And under President Trump, for the first time, we're seeing Latinos come forward and say, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of new groups out there. Bienvenido, you know, Latinos for Trump. Everybody that's working with you and your campaign and the outreach. And I see it here in Virginia, too. So what do you think's happened here? Do you think that President Trump, being this populist president, really reaching out, has made a shift in the communities where they're saying, wait a minute, we don't want to believe these lies anymore that are coming 100%. Out of the Democrats. Is that
100%. It? 100%. Because the Democrats, you know, the left, the liberal media that's in the tank for the Democrats, they understand Americans and Latino Americans, Hispanic Americans are smart, and they don't want to be taken for granted. We're not tolerating the disrespect anymore. We have to be counted. We are showing up to work and try to live and breathe the American dream. And the left and Joe Biden and his crew want to say that you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you need to be dependent on the government to be able to make a living and provide to your family. And we totally reject those weakened victim policies that they tell us. We reject it wholeheartedly. This country, part of the reason it's one of the greatest countries on earth is because of the people who have come here, yes, also from other countries, to say, we want to come here lawfully, peacefully, and be able to live the American dream for our family. You know, Joe Biden doesn't get it. He's totally out of touch. And guess what? America is out of time for those failed policies of the left that weaken and break the spirit and dreams of American people.
Wow. Amen to that. Now, talk about broken policies and a broken campaign when you think of Joe Biden. I want to bring this up. This is breaking news today. Andrew Weissman, who was the lead prosecutor in the now debunked, basically special counsel prosecution, trying to prove Russia collusion and nothing there. Now we're seeing how many criminals were actually involved in this from the Obama administration, is basically going to do a virtual fundraiser, a fireside chat fundraiser for Joe Biden. This is really bizarre, Kimberly, because when you think about this, they're supposed to be, you know, objective. These prosecutors were supposed to stand outside of the political sphere, just look at the facts, deliver the facts to the American people. We see now that that never happened. And now we have this lead prosecutor, who, by the way, was at the Javits Center crying, I'm sure, when Hillary Clinton lost, now throwing a fireside chat with marshmallows for Joe Biden. What do you have to say about that?
I got to tell you something. I'm not even that surprised anymore. The shock and the disgust that I've seen day after day, week after week, month after month from these people trying to rip a duly elected president out of the White House, out of the Oval Office. They have no morals. They have no ethics. This just also further goes to prove that this was a partisan witch hunt based on ideology and wanting to get a mulligan for the election to try to take the president out, to spy on the family, to spy on the campaign, unmasking individuals, and to try to put behind bars an American war hero in General Flynn. These people will stop at nothing. They don't even care. They think the American people are stupid, that they can sit there and do a virtual fundraiser with somebody who was supposed to be an objective prosecutor. I take offense to that, serving faithfully as a prosecutor, upholding in a way that was so important the rule of law. And what we're seeing now is he'll take money from anybody, and they had it in. The fix was in to get a predicted outcome to try to take the president out of office. But Americans are going to reject it. We're too smart and we're tired of it. And enough is enough.
Wow. Kimberly, thank you so much for being here. Where can Americans go if they want to be a part of the campaign, if they want to get involved? Where can Latinos go to be a part of this? What can we do to ensure that November is successful and that we all get the results that we want?
Yes, you can join our populist army. Join Team Trump. We have Team Trump online events every single night. Fantastic programming. You can reject the mainstream media. There's other avenues out there, just like your podcast. And we're doing these every single night, these virtual events, to reach across the fabric of this country to every single American that wants to fight back, that isn't going to be silenced, that's tired of the investigations, that wants a president that respects them, that earns their vote with every move. That's why we're telling people to choose President Trump. Go to DonaldJTrump.com and find out how you can volunteer. We have neighborhood Team Trump leaders. We've registered and, in fact, trained over 1 million volunteers that are coming together because President Trump has built a populist army across this country of liberty and freedom-loving Americans that are going to take this country back and bring it to its greatness again. And it's going to happen under President Trump on November 3rd.
Well, there you go, folks. You know where to go now if you want to be a part of this historic time in our history. You can go there. You could be a part of this greatness and be a part of change. Thank you so much, Kimberly, for being with me today, and hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you for having me on, Sarah.
Wasn't that great? That was a great interview with Kimberly Guilfoy. I mean, I look forward to seeing every time, every night, these shows that are coming from the Trump campaign, because they tell me so much about what they're doing and how they're working and, you know, actually how important the Latino community is right now in this upcoming election. You and I both know that, but right now I'm going to segue right over to Jenna Ellis because she can explain the legal aspects of what's going on both in the Flynn case and with coronavirus. And you know what? I want to get her thoughts on John Ratcliffe. Hi, Jenna. I'm so glad you can come back on the Sarah Carter Show. I love having you on because this
Thanks
is like,
so
I think I keep asking you to come back on because I'm reading your columns and every time we talk, there's always something new happening. And today is really important because actually today, John Ratcliffe just got nominated to Director of National Intelligence. I mean, this is awesome. But that means that acting director Rick Grenell will no longer be there. And I mean, he has been absolutely incredible at moving things forward at the DNI. He has been incredible at declassifications, a cleaning house. What do you think? I saw your tweet. I retweeted it. You think that Grenell, like I do, should be moved to another agency, right? Or another department?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that Rick Grenell has been the second greatest decision that Donald Trump has made in his presidency. The first decision that was so great was to fire James Comey early on in the administration. Can you imagine what a different posture we would be in had Donald Trump not acted, even in the midst of all of the flack that he got? That was, of course, one of his executive decisions that the president has the power to do. And so now, with Rick Grenell declassifying all of this, just simply putting forward the truth in transparency. There's no reason why anything that he has declassified should have remained hidden from the view of the American people. And I think that John Ratcliffe, I got to know him really well through the whole impeachment drama, which seems like such a long time ago, right? Even though ended in February. Ratcliffe was one of the champions for truth and for the Constitution in that whole era. And I think he's going to continue the wonderful work that Rick Grenell has started. And Donald Trump now has a great opportunity to then use Rick Grenell and put him into another acting position. Some people are calling for him to replace Christopher Wray at the FBI. That's a great decision over, like you've said, at the DOD or state. I mean, I think that some of these people who are genuinely wanting to make sure that the American people have faith restored in our system. They don't care about the swamp. They don't care about, politics as usual. They just want the truth to come out about this this setup of Michael Flynn and also extreme undermining by the Obama administration and deep state actors to undermine our American constitutional system of peaceful transition of power. That's the bottom line of what happened here. And for the Obama administration to not allow the Trump administration to come in with all information is absolutely unacceptable.
Well, I think what we've seen, Jenna, and you and I have talked about this before, is how people have been embedded in the system, right? So it didn't matter really that the American people voted in the past for their president, whether it's Republican or Democrat. You had so many people embedded in the bureaucracy that they were the power, right? So even if the president wanted to move forward with a particular issue or particular policy, if the people in the bureaucracy didn't agree with it, they could just slow roll. They could make life impossible for the president or for the administration. And with President Trump, we've really seen that go into overdrive. And I think Rick Grenell, I'm going to give him the nickname the cleaner, right? I want him to be the cleaner. I want to move him over to state. I think FBI, that's awesome. I never even heard of that, but that would be great. But move him over to State Department or DOD. I personally, if I was President Trump, I know he's probably going to want to move him to state. That's what I've been hearing. That's the rumor, right? If Mike Pompeo, moves out of Secretary of State position, he could move Rick Grenell in there, and that would be fantastic because there's a lot of deep swamp dwellers in the State Department. But what about the Defense Department? Because we know the Defense Department has long had problems and is probably one of the biggest issues for this administration right now. So I'm all about moving Rick Grenell wherever he needs to go. But you brought up Mike Flynn, and Lieutenant General Michael Flynn has been through so much. And I know you've been talking about this and you've been focused on Flynn. I want to ask you a quick question. Tell our listeners out there, for the regular layman like me, what did it mean when Sidney Powell, put in for the U.S. Appeals Court the writ of mandamus, for General Flynn to have Judge Sullivan removed and to have the case thrown out altogether? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so in basic lay terms, what's going on here is that the prosecution and the defense in any criminal case are in conflict, right? That's our adversarial system. You have that posture. And so in any other criminal context, and I've been a prosecutor, I've been a defense attorney, so I've seen both sides of this, when the prosecution files a motion to dismiss in the case and says, hey, for, whatever valid legal reason, even if they don't really explain, they just say, on our prosecutorial discretion, we are no longer pursuing these charges, then the judge is not supposed to weigh in with an opinion on that. And so when it's the defendant, like Michael Flynn, who has petitioned for a motion to dismiss in the past, you're still at an adversarial posture. The government's objecting, and the defendant saying, hey, we want it dismissed for legal reasons. So then the judge weighs in on matters of law, not on a politically biased opinion. But what's happening here is that Judge Emmett Sullivan is actually putting himself in an adversarial posture against the government and the defendant, who are now on the same side in a criminal case. This is absurd. He's stepping off the bench, basically. He's taking his robe off and he's saying, I'm now the prosecutor. I want to compel you, government, to continue this prosecution. It's constitutionally absurd. And so what he's done here has
And it has not been supported by the courts, right? I mean, it has not been supported by the courts. There is precedence here that he should not be doing this, right?
Absolutely. And especially now that he's allowing these amicus filings, which just basically means friend of the court, he's allowing these statements to come in and argue this motion that has no legal merit. I mean, what does he think he's going to do? Force the government and command them, you have to continue to prosecute Michael Flynn when you know that that's against the interest of justice? No, that's never going to stand up. All he's doing, and I wrote a piece in Fox News earlier this week that said, you know, that this is just a political scam where Judge Sullivan, all he wants to do is delay ruling on this motion. And he wants political statements to get into the record so that once he ultimately has to dismiss the case, then the Democrats and these other liberal political pundits can use those statements on the record to still continue the complete smear of Michael Flynn. So what Sidney Powell has done with that overview, what she's done is filed what's called a petition for writ of mandamus, which is, you know, just this big fancy legal term that is basically asking the DC Court of Appeals to step in, and mandamus means in Latin, we command or by our command. And she's asking the higher court to tell Judge Sullivan, you are outside of your bounds of the law as a judge. We are coming in and we are intervening as the higher court, and we are going to tell you, you have to follow the law. You have to dismiss this case. You can't allow any amicus statements on the record. And Sidney asked for the case to be transferred to a different judge if there are any further proceedings so that there isn't this political bias. That absolutely should happen.
Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I think that the DOJ will likely file their own mandamus as well, and they will also ask the court to intervene. So, you know, the DC Court of Appeals is pretty liberal in composition, but hopefully they will recognize that, you know, hey, their boss is the Supreme Court, and if they get it wrong and they're overturned, that is going to look so politically bad and biased. I hope that they will follow the law and that they will go ahead and issue that writ, and this will be done within the next couple of weeks.
All right. I want to go to something that's really important, Jenna. And I know it just kind of buttresses right off of Mike Flynn, but it's a legal issue. And that's why I come to you, because I want to understand what these legal issues that we're dealing with, whether it's Michael Flynn or whether it's coronavirus, come into play. Alan Dershowitz was on Tucker Carlson's show, and he basically made a statement that made it sound like the American people could be forced into vaccinations for COVID-19. Now, I have never heard that, because there are a lot of people that are anti-vaxxers. I'm not one of them. My kids have all their vaccinations. I have my vaccinations. But I've always believed that, you know, it's the choice of the person, whether or not that person chooses to get vaccinated, especially under our system of government and based on our own civil liberties and our rights. What do you think is going on here? Can people be forced to be vaccinated for coronavirus? Is that something that is in the foreseeable future? Is there a change here?
Not at all. And, you know, when we talk about the emergency nature of pandemics, that does put the state in a different posture in terms of what they're able to do with the overall safety and health of their communities. But what Alan Dershowitz failed to talk about was the entire case. So this goes back to 1905 with the smallpox pandemic. And there was a vaccine that was available, and a local ordinance required their communities to get that vaccine. And the penalty that they imposed was a $5 fine, right? Which in, of course, 1905 terms was more significant than it would be today. Right. And so a clergy member said that because of health reasons and other things, he objected. And so the city enforced the fine that went up to the Massachusetts Supreme Court that said, listen, the penalty for this just being a fine, they specifically said there's nothing that that says that the state can force or can compel a person to get a vaccine. The only measure that's on the line here is this monetary fine. So they allowed that. The Supreme Court upheld the fine. So what Alan Dershowitz got wrong is that even though mandatory vaccinations in the midst of a pandemic can, in some instances, be mandatory. It depends on the ordinance. It depends on the nature of the vaccine, the medical science behind it. We can talk about body integrity laws. We can talk about moral objections. All of those things are still arguments And there's still ways that you can combat this. But the bottom line here is that he is purely fear-mongering. When he says the government can round you up and can plunge a needle into your arm, that's absolutely false. That is not what the Supreme Court has ever held. All that they have allowed for is a fine if you disobey the law. I mean, similarly to any other sort of mandatory law that if you choose to disregard or you choose to violate, then the government can impose penalties. But that doesn't mean that it can force you to undergo a vaccination when you have a conscientious or other objection. And there should, if we ever get to that point, there will be certain carve outs and other ways that, we could certainly push back on that. And I also want to be clear, Sarah, that President Trump has never, ever suggested that he would even recommend to the states or, of course, from a national level, that he would ever try to make a vaccine mandated. This would come, if it ever did, from overreaching state or local governors. And so we just need to be prepared. And the best way that we can make sure that that never happens is to vote on the state and local level to get conservatives in office that understand, hey, this isn't really the best way to combat the COVID-19 virus now that we understand more about the nature of the virus. This isn't the best way. If there's a vaccine available, great, it's available, but it's your choice.
And he's always left it up to the states. President Trump has always left it up to the local governments, the states, in order to issue whatever they need to do to protect their states, to do what's best for their states. Now we're seeing a lot of divide between the states, you know, whether some states decide to open up a little bit more in a broader scope than other states. What do you think's happening here? How do you think the economy is going to handle this kind of like divisive, slow rolling opening in some states, whereas some states are moving a lot quicker? Do you think that's going to affect the overall federal government actions that the president can take? Or do you think it's the smart way of doing things?
Well, I think that, all of the governors need to recognize that the economy needs to reopen now, and that shouldn't depend on, what state it's in. My good friend David Marcus wrote a great piece that was on the cover of New York Post today, talking about that New York, even, which has been kind of the central hotbed for this, needs to reopen because health, safety, and welfare as a general concern, and that's where the states have police power to implement some of these regulations. Health, safety, and welfare isn't just about one virus and one threat to health safety. This is about an overall multi-variable scenario where not only do you have other risk factors like immunocompromising and some other physical health safety ideas that are now being put into risk, but also health, safety, and welfare includes the economy. It includes the right to engage in commerce. It includes the right to make sure that you're able to participate in work and provide for your families. And so looking at the nature of this, the longer that these stay-at-home orders are in place, I think the worse the argument is that the governors and the state and local leaders have any constitutional legitimacy in continuing these orders the long that they go. So from a wide perspective, it shouldn't even be on a rolling scale. It should be something that governors are saying to states, hey, here are the federal recommendations. We trust you, the American people, to weigh the risk factors, to comply with social distancing. But if you can do it with your small business, you can reopen, period. It's not up to us. They don't have the power to determine what is or isn't an essential business. They never have.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, I want you to comment really quickly. Adam, if you could, I'd like to play a clip of the Boston business owner that discusses his business in lieu of coronavirus and his own feelings as a business owner about what's happened.
To give up my business that I worked 25 years, sacrificed my life for, okay? For coronavirus, I'll take coronavirus over losing my business, okay? And I guarantee you, 99% of the people who are here will do the same thing.
On Twitter, that's all I saw. We were people that were coming out and supporting him. Of course, there were those that were saying, like, he's not thinking about others. And, we hear the other arguments. But there's a lot of people with businesses out there that have lost and fear they're going to lose everything they've worked for in their lives. And they're not getting the loans because they either didn't apply in time or the banks haven't gotten the loans to them yet. So they're really, really scared. What would your message be? I mean, think about the civil liberties here, Jenna, because we've talked about this a lot, just individual liberties. You talked about common sense. I always say that. I have always said that the most important thing is to trust the American people, that the American people have common sense to do the right thing and to help one another. Not everybody's going to act the same way. That's true. But overall, we pretty much are a society that abides by rules and understands that we're going to do our best to mitigate the spread of this virus. I see it every time I go to Safeway or whenever I go downtown. People are wearing masks. People are taking precautions. For the most part, everybody's trying to do their part. What do you say to a guy who's really scared, who says, look, I would rather take this risk than see my business at 25 years just go down a proverbial toilet?
Well, that's exactly what our Declaration of Independence recognizes, is that when we have as individuals the fundamental God-given unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that means that we as individuals get to make our own decisions. We get to weigh the individual risk. We get to have the information and decide what's best for ourselves and for our families. And for some people, they may look at the cost-benefit analysis and say, you know what, I need to reopen. I need to engage in my business because that's what's most important to my family right now. And they should be able to do that. And for the people who may be in a high-risk situation that still want to stay at home and still want to, you know, order their groceries online, they don't want to go out to restaurants, they can do that too, because that's best for themselves in their situations. And so we need to recognize the purpose of government is to protect and preserve individual rights. And while there is a common good principle, that type of common good principle has to still allow the flexibility for individual people to say, here's the risk factors, here's how we're weighing this. And for myself and my family, I'm going to do this and reopen while I'm maintaining compliance with the overall general imposition of regulations like social distancing and things that are reasonable, that you can comply with. And so reasonable here is the operative term. And to just say, to put a complete ban on reopening businesses, a ban on churches, a ban on our ability to provide for ourselves and our families, that is not constitutional. That's not the idea and the purpose of government, but simply to provide for the best measure of safety while not being too overbroad. It has to be narrowly tailored by the least restrictive means. And for people who can social distance, they can do that. We need to reopen.
That's awesome. And that's why I have you on the show, Jenna Ellis, because you can explain things to us that others can't. I mean, this is about individual freedoms, about civil liberties, and about having common sense. And you're exactly right. That is what the government is established for. It's not there to babysit us, to control us. Otherwise, we'd live in, you know, the former USSR, right? We'd live in the Soviet Union or some other country. Oh, like China, right? Where they control pretty much every aspect of the individual lives. This is America. We have common sense. We can be trusted to make the right decisions for ourselves. And thank you so much for being on the show today. You know, I'm always happy to have you on. I can't wait to have you back.
Thanks. Sounds so good, Sarah. And, you know, it's such a great opportunity for us as Americans to rediscover civics and liberty and understand why, even if we disagree with the person next door and, you know, they want to reopen, we want to stay at home. That's the freedom and liberty that we have in America. And that's why President Trump says we will never become a socialist country, because guess what? The freedom and right to disagree is paramount. And so we need to protect and preserve that. So I'm always happy to come on. Love chatting with you. Thanks for having with me.
I love chatting with you too, Jenna. Stay safe, and hopefully I'll see you real soon.
Sounds good.
Okay, that was awesome. And I always love talking to Jenna because, you know, we get right into civil liberties and issues that I think interest you most out there. I want to bring up something, though. There is a website that I frequently check out because it's so funny. It's the Babylon Bee. And there's always these great stories. Okay, all the stories are fake. They're not real, okay? But there's this one story that is so great. It's called, I'm going to read it to you. And Jenny was the one that pointed this out to me. Bar enforces social distancing by having all patrons wear Che Guevara t-shirts. You got to read this story because it's so hilarious. So basically, we've been seeing all the weird stories out there. Adam, I don't know if you've been apprised of this, but have you seen all those weird stories out there where bars and restaurants are trying to make patrons feel comfortable because they have to socially distance. So they either put fake cardboard cutouts of people in the chairs that are empty, or that there's one in Maryland where you have to have this like big inner tube that keeps you like 6 feet apart from every other patron. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's the one I was going to discuss. It's an outdoor seated bar with just a massive, you know, tube that you would basically go snow tubing on, and they're all posted up outside. So now everybody has to get in there. I'm trying to think after just the 3 or 4 beers how I'm going to be getting that beer into that inner tube without spilling anything. Could be interesting.
Right. And not only that, they have wheels on them, right? So it's like you're driving drunk, right?
I mean, it's almost like bumper cars at the bar. I can't imagine that's going to end well, but I'm all for it if it gets us out of the house.
Well, it's totally funny, right? But this story basically is like some bar owner that puts people in a Che Guevara t-shirt. Now, for everybody out there who doesn't know Che Guevara, maybe some of you don't, but you know, he was like the right-hand guy to Fidel Castro, part of the revolution in Cuba, communist. So this bar owner quote in here is like, "It's working great," said bar owner Bud Kirkpatrick. "Nobody wants to talk to you when you're wearing a Che Guevara t-shirt, so everyone just sits by themselves." So maybe there's a better way. Maybe we don't need bumper cars or fake patrons. Maybe we just put people in t-shirts that are offensive.
Now, Larry David did this on Curb Your Enthusiasm with the MAGA hats. He was basically just wearing a MAGA hat and Make America Great hat, and he was using it as a buffer to keep everybody away from him.
You know, in Los Angeles, I could see that working. In LA, right?
No doubt, not
so much. There are people now more shifting. Made those independents that have shifted over to President Trump. But yeah, in LA, putting on a MAGA hat, I could. And you know, Larry David, he loves to be alone. He doesn't want anyone bugging him, so I could totally see that being part of his show too. That would be funny. An idea. We throw it out there. Just, you know, maybe you guys can come up out there with your own idea. Like, what T-shirt would you wear to keep people away from you? Right? What t-shirt would keep people away from you, socially distance, and ensure that 6 feet is maintained? I don't know. Jenny, do you have any ideas?
This sounds really bad, but I mean, wouldn't you just wear a shirt that says, "I have COVID"?
Nice.
Okay. That's kind of like people who use their wireless internet and they just name it virus. Like, that's a really good idea right there.
Actually, I think Jenny came up with the perfect t-shirt, because everybody would leave you alone. Not only, they wouldn't even come near you. It'd be like 50 feet, right? 50 feet away, and you wouldn't even have anything to worry about. Now, other people may be wondering, you have to wear a mask if you wear that shirt, though, right? You got to wear a mask if you wear that shirt, because then people will be angry. You don't want someone getting up in your face in their mask with, you know, without having your own mask on. But that's a great t-shirt, Jenny. Great point. So we've gone through so much on the show today. I want to just throw it out to Adam, to Jenny, Logan, and everyone out there that is working in a small business like we are here. You know, how important it is, you know, for all of us to stick together, to continue to fight for our civil liberties, our freedom. And, you know, as we start to open up again in America, as we start to look forward to life getting back to normal, we see the light at the end of the tunnel. Let's just remember that we really are. And I hate saying this because it's been annoying me on the Disney Channel a lot.
But it's true.
We are in this together. What? I'm trying to be positive.
No, I know. I know. New. And honestly, it doesn't hit home unless somebody like you says it, because you actually know the inner workings of these things from behind the scenes. So I do feel better hearing it from you.
Oh, well, thank you. But it's, you know, it's tough. I mean, we're all trying to make it through. And, you know, there's still so much that we don't even know. Right. I mean, I'm worried about what we don't know, the unknown. What could happen in the fall if there's a second wave of this virus, if the government continues to have shutdowns. But I'm going to think positive, and I'm going to think about things that, you know, that we could do together to ensure that all of us get through this. You know, support your local businesses, support the people out there that are working. Try to keep people working for you. Remember, this is about all of us. And thank you so much for being a part of the Sarah Carter Show. And don't forget, even if you're at home, you can be involved. You can get out there and, you know, join the whatever campaign you want to join. We've got a lot of things happening here that keep us busy. So anyway, thank you so much. God bless. Follow me on Twitter. It's Sarah Carter DC, and I'll be seeing you next week.